country's two other main ethnic populations, the Croats and the Muslim Bosniaks. In July 1995, Bosnian Serbs overran a UN-protected zone in Srebrenica. They separated at least 8,000 Muslim Bosniak men, including young boys, from their wives, mothers and sisters, and slaughtered them in the surrounding woods. The perpetrators then ditched the victims' bodies in hastily dug mass graves. The massacre has been declared a genocide by international and national courts. But still, Serbian leaders in Bosnia and neighbouring Serbia downplay or even deny the murders, despite irrefutable evidence of what happened. Today, anti-Muslim hate remains high, and many activists fear that other European countries are showing early signs of the same Islamophobia which eventually led to the horrors committed in Bosnia not that long ago.
Well, joining us today to talk about Srebrenica and Islam in Bosnia, we have two esteemed guests here in the studio in London. We're joined by Hussein Ali Diakidis, who is the campaign's manager for the Islamic Human Rights Commission. And joining us from Bosnia on Skype, we have Demir Mahmud Shehajic. Demir has written and spoken about genocide in Bosnia, its causes and consequences for the last 25 years. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. I'm just going to start off with you, Hussein, because I think that one thing is that we should speak about is the fact that Bosnia remains an example of when things go very badly wrong. Perhaps you could just give us what you know. Your activism work has spoken about this many times.
I think what Bosnia shows is how easily genocide can come out of almost from nowhere. I think a lot of Muslims as well should really look at what's happened from the point of view that as much as you might try westernization to try and fit in or to fight Islamophobia, these were white European Muslims who were basically treated the same way as any other Muslim would during a genocide. In fact, they've got it worse than many Muslims in the world. So I think that's one of the scariest things, I think, for us, that we might be here in the West and thinking we're treated differently to how Muslims are treated abroad. But we're just as likely to come under the same sort of massacre. Bosnia was part of the same country as Serbia at one time. They were the same. They were basically like, would have considered each other like brothers, as was taught by the Tito, that they were all one people. But they didn't stop them from doing what they did.
Absolutely. Demir, let me bring you in now. Obviously, based in Bosnia, you know the history and the legacy that that horrific war has had on your country. Perhaps you could give us your reflections on the 28th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre.
The Serb and Croatian forces within Bosnia and Herzegovina were part of the machinery that was run from Belgrade. They were receiving money, ammunition, guns, commanding officers, instructions, military plans, propaganda. Everything was run from Belgrade. And it's still continuing. The war in Bosnia and Herzegovina hasn't stopped. The war is going on. The only thing that stopped is shooting. There are no guns shooting, but there are many other ways of fighting. Just yesterday in Srebrenica, one of the returnees to Srebrenica, one of the survivors of genocide in Srebrenica, was arrested by the local police force because he complained that on the same day when 30 remains, body, or some parts of the bodies that were buried on anniversary of the genocide, the same day in the evening, a local, in front of the local church, there was a concert. There was a music being played out loud, very provocative towards the victims. We are having denial of genocide within the structures of both within Bosnia and Herzegovina and Serbia proper, very strongly encouraged to start some kind of disturbances in Bosnia again. And then we are being now suddenly given an extra burden of being some kind of bastion in Europe, where we are waiting almost on a daily basis when the guns are going to start shooting again. So this is very important to clarify in the beginning. As regards to the your question, the Islam in Bosnia and Herzegovina has been present all the time from the 1878 when the Ottomans left. They ran away. They left us at the mercy of Austro-Hungarian army. In my hometown, the local Muslim population was demanding from the leaving Ottoman soldiers to leave guns and ammunition so that the local population could defend themselves. They did not leave any guns. They left the local population defenseless. So the genocide in Bosnia from 1992 to 1995, because the genocide did not happen just in Srebrenica, international community has decided, so that it looks like an incident, that it happened only in Srebrenica. It happened in more than 60% of the Bosnia and Herzegovina. It was organized and planned, but it was not first time, and it was not surprising since the Ottoman Empire left in 1878. There's been 11 genocides against Bosnian Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina and part of the Serbia that is called Sandžak, and in Montenegro that has been inhabited by the Bosnian Muslims. So this has not been new. It's just that we've been surprised because a period of peace lasted unusually long, 50
Demir,
years.
I want to jump in just because I'm going to throw a question at our studio guest, but what you're saying is absolutely fascinating, and I am going to come back to you and give you more of a chance to update us and inform us about the rich history of Bosnia and its Muslim population. But let me come back to you, Hussein, because one thing I think that I feel fear about is that, you know, this genocide didn't happen very long ago. And Islamophobia is still a huge problem in Europe specifically. Do you fear that something like this could happen again?
Yes, definitely. One of the biggest problems we have is that not many people talk about the Bosnian genocide. It's not spoken about like the Holocaust or like other genocides that maybe more help Western foreign interests. I think one of the biggest fears at the moment is that we're seeing certain patterns happening across Europe, especially in France, of creating them, us and them sort of mentality towards Muslims, which are actually citizens in these countries. So this is one of the main fears that really could happen. I mean, we even have genocide denial when it comes to Bosnia, which is not something... Yeah. You'll see other than the fringes of the far right on the Holocaust. But here you'll find it on the left, on the right. You can find it anywhere. It's still very common. Mm. And when you don't remember that sort of history, history is likely to repeat itself.
It does seem strange to me as well that it's become so normalised that Muslims around the world are getting killed that it's almost like that's normal. That's an acceptable form of killing, in a way. That's how it seems in the media sometimes. Do you think that that's the case with the legacy from Srebrenica, the lack of interest perhaps from non-Muslim media sources?
Yeah, I think when it comes to Palestine, we are very good on Palestine generally when it comes to actually recognising what's going on and at least speaking out. We might not be doing as much as we could, but that's one genocide that we do look at. When it comes to the Rohingya, I don't hear it mentioned hardly at all anymore. And this is just sort of normalised. When you even hear Muslims being killed, people look at it, Muslims are always saying we're being killed here, we're being killed there. So it's almost
sometimes they even blame Muslims for the killings as if somehow they're killing themselves, when that's not always the case, actually. Well, we're going to continue this discussion shortly, but first let's take a look back at a bit of history to see how Islam first came to Bosnia, how it was suppressed, and how it is now being revived.
In the southeast of Europe, located in the Balkans, lies Bosnia and Herzegovina. Isolated from the Ummah, the small Muslim majority majority nation remains awkwardly inside Christendom. Surrounded by Europe's once great Christian nations, how did this country become and remain a bastion of Islam in the West? Culturally, politically, and socially, the country has a rich and complex history. The ancestors of the South Slavic peoples that populate the area today arrived during the 6th and through the 9th century. In the 12th century, the Banate of Bosnia was established. By the 14th century, this had evolved into the Kingdom of Bosnia. In the mid-15th century, it was annexed into the Ottoman Caliphate, under whose rule it remained until the late 19th century. The Ottomans brought Islam to the region, adding to and improving much of the country's cultural and social outlook. From the late 19th century until World War I, the country was annexed into the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. In the interwar period, Bosnia and Herzegovina was part of the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. After World War II, it was granted full republic status in the newly formed Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. However, the most shocking impact to affect the nation and forge its identity for years to come occurred after the collapse of Yugoslavia in 1992. A brutal civil war ensued, which led to horrific war crimes, specifically targeting Muslim Bosnians in many cases. Prior to the war, the country's identity was mostly secular, with socialist and Austrian rule eroding Islam into a backseat position. The horrors of the war led to what some have described as a revival of an Islamic identity, which the new nation Bosnia and Herzegovina has embraced with seemingly growing enthusiasm.
Well, there you have it. Damir, let me bring you back in on the discussion because you said some very interesting things earlier. What I do want to learn about more so is how Bosnia has developed now, how Islam has developed in Bosnia to this day, because I think some people might consider it to be a country which is seeing an Islamic revival. Other people might say, well, it's still quite secular. Just tell us, what is the position of Islam in Bosnia, particularly their cultural identity and their religious identity too?
It is not easy to decide how religious or how secular Bosnian Muslims are, because we've been left isolated from Ummah for so long. So it is something that we developed. I wouldn't say it's a Bosnian Islam. It's not that. It is an understanding that the survival on this land is on this vatan, on our fatherland, on our motherland, on the land that's been shed Shuhada's blood for so long. The survival in this land is the priority. This is the farthest for us. So there are times and needs and situations where we take that in consideration. You know? And this is not the same like, for example, the situation in Kosovo, where Muslims have a friendly border, let's say, or in any other country. We can, you know, even with the situation with the Rohingyas, they had the chance to run away, unfortunately, to Bangladesh, you know. But this, then we come back to the another question: why we are in such a situation? Why we are being attacked? Why we are being humiliated? Why we are being? Is it because we are not Islamic enough? Is it because we do not understand enough? Or is it because we are generally weak? We are, you know, if you are weak, you are being attacked. Like in animal kingdom, the lion or anybody else is going to look for a weak individual. It's not going to attack the strongest member of the herd. It's going to pick the weakest. What last aggression in Bosnia and Herzegovina from 92 to 95, including the genocides perpetrated, revived within the Bosnian Muslim population in general, is understanding of dignity and responsibility of living in this land. So many people returned back. They started their businesses. They brought know-how, their connection, and they are persisting here. We are being attacked every day, but we are in various ways, but we are also showing the other side. The Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam's example that we are not there to destroy our enemies. Our mission is to preserve our dignity, and with the dignity, show our enemies how they should behave. Of course, the priority is to preserve the dignity, and to preserve the dignity, well, we need to fight in every possible way until we become strong.
I want to jump in again there, Damir. You've made some very strong points, but I also want to bring in Hussein again, because one thing I want to ask you is about the fact that many countries who, you know, they swarm on the anniversary of the massacre to, you know, throw their solidarity towards the issue. Countries like the UK, for example, which actually historically didn't play a very positive role when the attacks against Muslims in former Yugoslavia was happening. Perhaps you could comment on that. What do you think of it?
I think one thing that must be remembered in the Balkans is there's a lot of nationalism that has been pumped in by the West, originally to destroy the Ottoman Empire, then to destroy Yugoslavia, then to destroy any sort of big-looking country or big-looking force. And so they spread a lot of hate and pump this into the countries. Then when the genocide is happening, they suddenly say, oh, now we're going to come in and get involved. But the genocide for them was a good thing in their eyes of the elites. It was something that helped their foreign interests and allowed them to come in. So I think that we can't really make out that the West were heroes or saviours of Bosnia. They've pumped in hatred in not just in the Yugoslavia, in all the Balkans, you know, including my ancestors who were killed in genocide as well much earlier. So we've got this sort of history that's been pumped in by the West, just like you see now in what's happening in Ukraine. Again, this is all nationalism that was pumped in to destroy the Soviet Union that's blowing up over. And so we must not forget that.
Absolutely, and I'm sure I was very young at the time, so I don't have the knowledge of that period to reference, but I'm sure that if the West was genuine that it wanted to help innocent people, then perhaps these genocides could have been avoided with some meaningful action. Who knows? But Damir, let me come back to you. We haven't got long left of the show. What I want to ask you is, what's the responsibility of the wider Ummah? What should the Ummah be doing to try and help the oppressed Muslims in Bosnia?
Well, first of all, I agree with Brother Hassan that the West is no hero in any way in Bosnia-Herzegovina. They were complacent with the aggression on Bosnia-Herzegovina by Serbia and Croatia, and they helped them from the early beginning by imposing arms embargo on a legitimate defense force army of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So we were not allowed even to defend ourselves. We could not buy arms. And this was done by the Western states, Western states. The so-called intervention by the USA and NATO and the Western allies at the end of the Bosnian War after the fall of Srebrenica was happening at the time when our forces, our army, was strong and liberating the Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Serbs forces were on the run. What should generally Ummah do? What should Muslims worldwide do at this point? Is very simple. Travel to Bosnia. Spend your holidays here. Spend your money here. Come, meet us, join us, live with us, visit our places, talk to us. This is once, you know, we've been left like for 20 years, you know, after the Bosnia left, the medians, you know, there was no interest anymore. Now we can welcome you.
Jump in there, Demir. We have reached the end of the show. I do apologize. I know there's plenty more that you could say, but I think we can all appreciate your wise words on this. Thank you to you, and thank you, Hussein, for joining us in the studio. That's all the time we have for this edition of Eye on Islam. But join us again next week for more as we discuss more issues of interest to the Muslim world. But for now, assalamu alaikum.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Respected scholars and elders and brothers and sisters. عَظَّمَ اللَّهُ أُجُورَنَا وَأُجُورَكُمْ بِمُصَابِنَا بِالْحُسَيْنِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. I begin by first of all sending my salam and my condolences to our beloved master and leader, the awaited Imam of our time, Ajallahu Farjahu Sharif, and all the respected believers. I send my condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram, of course, depending on the moon sighting. In Hadith, brothers and sisters, we're told that for our leaders, the arrival of this month, the sighting of the moon, was a transformational experience. Maybe there was a time in the past where this needed no explanation. For everyone, it was clear that when this new year comes about, unlike what most other cultures do in terms of a new year and celebration, for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, it is a time of transformation. But in these days, it's very important for us to remind ourselves about what we are doing and why we're doing it, in order to be able to continue this tradition and to deepen and to further it. So our masters, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, they would take this time very seriously. In one narration that's mentioned in our books of hadith, we're told that our 8th Imam alayhi as-salam says that the month of Muharram, even in the pre-Islamic era, was a time when the shedding of blood was prohibited. But it was the month in which they shed our blood. It was the month in which they violated our sanctity. It was the month in which they took our women and our children as prisoners. And then he says something very beautiful. He says, فَعَلَى مِثْلِ الْحُسَيْنِ فَلْيَبْكِ الْبَاكُونَ, which in a poetic way would say that if there's anyone who wishes to shed a tear, then let them shed a tear for the likes of Hussein alayhi salam. Then he describes the benefit of doing so. He says that somebody who is able to shed tears for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, it is an atonement for great sins. That is just one of the benefits of shedding the tear. And then he describes how his father, the 7th Imam alayhi salam, would be during this time. He says that my father would not be seen in the state of being joyful and jovial during this time. And as the days would progress, his grief would increase until it reached its climax on the 10th day of the month, in which it would be the day of his musibah and his huzn, his tragedy and his grief would be felt on that day in particular. And then he would say that huwa al-yawm alladhi qutila fihi al-Husayn, this is a day in which Hussein alayhi salam was killed. So when we gather together for these commemorations, they have incredible value. They are completely taking the seerah, the way of life of the great ones, and putting into practice at our times. What are we trying to get out of these? What is the purpose of them? I want to share with you some points of guidance from our great scholars, where they describe to us some of the outcomes that we would like to have and some things that we would want to stay away from during this time. The first purpose, brothers and sisters, that we're here for is to become acquainted with or to deepen our understanding of the teachings of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We're here to learn. We're here to be reminded. This Imam of ours, this Shaheed, was able to demonstrate so much in his actions, and every one of them is worth studying from many different angles. And every year, you must have noticed that as you come to the majalis and you think about what took place and you learn from the different opportunities that are presented, your understanding, your ma'rifah, it deepens. This is one of the very important goals that we would like to achieve. Our understanding of Imam Hussein alayhi salam right now, compared to what is going to be, inshallah, after the day of Ashura, we should have increased. The second goal and objective, brothers and sisters, is that once we have reacquainted and deepened our understanding of the teachings of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we need to be looking to see how can we be leading Husseini lives. This is one of the outcomes that we are trying to achieve. Some type of practical change that is taking place. Because knowledge is truly beneficial when it is acted upon. You've heard the story of the beggar who was so hungry that he was crying out of his hunger. And the rich man comes along and he says to him, "What is it that's making you cry?" He says, "I'm so hungry." So the rich man had just bought a whole loaf of bread. He sits down next to the poor man and he says that, "You're crying, I'm going to cry with you as well." So the two of them have a good cry. And then the rich man gets up and he says, "I had a good cry with you, goodbye." And the poor man says, "Well, thank you. But I was hoping for some of the bread, because really I'm crying because of hunger, and the bread that you have would help me." The rich man says that, "I can give you my tears, but I can't give you my bread. That's for me, the tears are for you." That's not the way we want to be. Inshallah, we are here to offer our tears. We are here to offer our sacrifice. We're here to offer our sweat and our blood in terms of the amount of efforts that take place in running programs like this. The brothers and sisters who are involved with these, may Allah reward them for their tireless efforts. But we want more than that as well. How can we lead the Husseini lifestyle? And the third goal that our great scholars encourage us to think about is this, that how can we think about the larger goals of Islam and how to achieve those? Preparation for the Imam of our time, the revival and the reformation of Islam, introducing Islam to those who are hungry for guidance and they don't know about this beautiful teachings. This is one of the third goal that we would say we want to, inshallah, achieve from our gatherings. Now, at the same time, our respected scholars, may Allah preserve them, they also say that we should be careful about a couple of things. What are those things? One of them, they say that when it comes to these gatherings, we should avoid doing what's called ifrat and tafrit, meaning avoid going to the extremes. What does it mean to go to the extreme? It's not that, of course, we know that there's no limit when it comes to the love of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. There's no limit when it comes to my passion for being a Husseini. But when it comes to my practice, I have to realize that Allah Ta'ala has given me responsibilities. And I want to make sure that my commemoration for Imam Hussein alayhi salam does not prevent me from performing my other responsibilities.
Oh, Hussein, you live forever
in our hearts and
till my last breath, I will remember Hussein. Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds. I swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
In your name rests an infinity of mercy and love. So in thy name I shall start. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies from all around the world. You're listening to your own program, Muslim Lady. And this is IRB English Radio. I am Asma, as your host. I have the pleasure to be with Sister Zainab in here. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Walaikum assalam, and assalamu alaikum to you and your listeners.
It's, again, so much of pleasure to be here with you. Previously, on Muslim Lady, we were talking about the gatherings and how to get prepared for these gatherings of the holy month of Muharram. Since the mothers, they are the ones behind the scenes, they are the ones who prepare everything and start to have a plan for the month, for all the donations, for all the gatherings, for all the, you know, they bring everything together. So we were saying that for those people who have never had such experiences, it's very good to have some clues about how and what to go through in order to get prepared for these gatherings and in order to organize all these gatherings. Sister Zainab was telling us that you have to take care of the sound systems, and then you have to think about the venue. You have to think about all these, you know, behind the scenes sort of items that you have to have in your mind. Then also, we talked about the fact that it's not just about the organizations. We have to enlighten ourselves as well. So just by having this in mind, let's go for more of items to take care of for the holy month of Muharram.
Right. So, yeah, what we're talking about is for someone who has never had the privilege to host a Hussaini Majlis, what kind of preparations they should be taking into the mind. So we said, first of all, they should choose a venue that should be spacious enough. If it's a mosque, it could be a community hall, it could be a Hussainiya. We explained that we have to take care of these sound systems.
Now, even in your home, even in a small room, you know, it does
depending on the population. Attendees.
It's just about having some ideas about this month.
Yeah. Then you again have to, when talking about the venue, we said you got to be taking care of the sound system. And again, you got to be taking care of the decoration of that venue, you know,
exactly.
Should be decorated with black cloth, the banners, the flags, and other symbols of mourning and respect for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because we, as Shias, do believe that there's a presence of Imam Mahdi,
exactly, and Lady Fatima Zahra, exactly. We have it that whenever there is a gathering for her son, she would be present in that gathering.
She would be present in those gatherings. So when we choose the venue, it's not just choosing the venue. It's not just taking care of the carpets, the chairs, the sound system. It's again decorating it with black, showing all that respect and love for Imam Hussain al-Islam and his family. Then you got to be inviting the participants. Attendees could be like, it's a Husseini Majlis is open to everyone, basically. You have to choose the speaker very, very carefully. Mm-hmm. The one who I am inviting to be as a speaker in this, to deliver a sermon, to narrate the narratives of Karbala. He should be very knowledgeable. So it could be a scholar. Then you have to invite the poets who, recite the laments and then show that experience and expertise in that particular field. Then arranging the food and water, whatever the charity you're giving away. It could include serving food and water to the attendees as a way of, honoring Imam Hussain al-Islam. That's so beautiful, and we have a lot of hadiths regarding that. It shows us that, community value, how you take care about the rights of others, how you give in the name of Imam Hussain al-Islam, how sincere your intentions are. And while you are giving away, there's so much this beautiful thing that I have seen in many people, devoted people, when they share water, they write on that. When you drink this water, remember Imam Hussain al-Islam, or send a salam, salutation on Imam Hussain al-Islam. That's so, so beautiful. I would also see that in the month of Muharram in Kashmir, we have these young boys who gather and just bring those cold mineral water bottles. They buy them. And in that hot, scorching sun, they distribute them freely in the name of Hussain al-Islam. And that's so, so beautiful.
So much beautiful ritual, really.
Exactly. That's the Hussainiyat. That's how you deliver just by distributing cold water in the hot, sunny day.
Yeah.
Delivers in itself who Hussain is and who the followers of Hussain are.
Mm-hmm.
Then this food and water that you're distributing should be simple, first of all. Because if you're trying to make it complicated, then others who want to host, it may become a barrier for them. So keep it simple and keep it halal.
Speaking of simplicity, I would tell you something of my own experience, but just at the right now, let's go for the break and then be back.
Countless voices crying, mourning, weeping with grief and pain. Had I a sword, I would defend the veil of Zainab. Countless voices crying, mourning, weeping with grief and pain. Had I a sword, I would defend the veil of Zainab.
So I remember, just as we were talking about simplicity, I just remembered my own experience when I was a child. I say when I was a child because mostly those were the time when you go to special places without your own, you did not decide for it. You're just taken with your family. I remember my mother took me to a sort of a special gathering every Muharram. It was a little house. And then all these ladies, they were mostly aged ladies. And then they had this ritual of giving teas and some special cookies. Very simple and very easy, but it was so amazing. The feeling that we as children got in that little house was in a way that all of my friends and I, we were always waiting for those days to come to get gathered in that house and then listen to all the poems in there. And then, all the experience that you get there. I'm just saying that it was simple, but at the very same time, it had such a great impact that we remember it even after all these years.
Keeping things simple is very necessary, and I think I have the simplest thing I have ever seen in the name of Hussain was on the streets of Karbala.
Yeah,
when I was traveling from Najaf to Karbala, I know there was this small girl, I think 3 years or 4 years old, who was standing in the middle of the road with a tissue box.
Yeah.
So I was like, can someone even imagine that I can distribute just tissues in the name of Hussain al-Islam? Because it's a sunny day and also some people are, shedding tears.
Exactly.
They need this tissue. Mm-hmm. They kept it so simple, but they, you know, generosity was there. Mm-hmm. Compassion was there. Humility was there. Kindness was there, you know, giving away in the name of a saint. Especially even in these majalis we not only give food ourselves as a host, we also, you know, there are some boxes that I saw in these majalis, and then you collect money for the, you know, who are sick.
Exactly.
Or the deprived people
for
of the society.
Charity.
Exactly. And you don't mention the names for whom this, mm-hmm. you know, help is being taken out. So that's again beautiful. That's again, you know, strengthens that bond of community within us. So, you know, this Hussaini Majlis has a lot to...
So without the government, people come together, and with the help of each other, they even in these gatherings, they even come to help the sick people, the orphans,
the
people
deprived.
Who are going to get married, but they did not have enough of money. For the people who are just striving for even food.
Exactly. So there are a lot of these, you know, things that happen in the Hussaini Majalis that a host has to be taken care of. But I think what could be added, what I personally felt like is missing still in many of the Majalis today, is that at the end when a speaker, you know, when the preacher completes his sermon, or when everything is, like, you know, done, there should be a session of question answering for the curious people who
exactly.
have just come to into the, you know, this gathering, who want to know more, and who are curious people who are interested, who want to know more about
which
you.
Is so enlightening.
Yeah. And I think this is still missing even today. This question answer session should be there at the end of
exactly.
the sermons. I think that's the only part I saw missing in many of the majalis.
Specifically for the younger generation.
Yeah, but there are in many of the majalis, of course. But I said in most of the majalis, I saw this missing, which could be done. A host, mm-hmm. if he wants to prepare, he should be prepared for this time as well. So a speaker should be given a particular time, not the, you know, lengthy hours that the audience gets bored. It should be informed in the very beginning, like, see, if you're coming on this particular day delivering a particular sermon, your time is this much, mm-hmm. so that he can, you know, compile that content up to that, so that he takes care about the times of, she takes care about the time of others as well. Now, also the people who are attending this majlis, they also need preparations. Not only the host needs preparations.
The Muslim ladies, we're talking to you. You also have to get prepared for this holy month of Muharram. And of course, there is a special sort of preparation for this month for the women themselves, as for us. So before we get into more of details, let's go for the break as usual, and then we'll be back. This is Arab English Radio. You're listening to your own program, Muslim Ladies. We're talking about you and how you can organize a gathering for yourself at your homes. Just for the record, in order not to have any misunderstanding, I would say that in order to have a gathering for the holy month of Muharram at your home, or in order to be a part of it, you do not have to go for such a drastic thing or from such a difficult organizing to go through. Just to have the will that I want to do something, even by just a box of water bottle that you just mentioned, you can share some money with the groups of people who do the donation or do these gatherings. Or you can have a small gathering in your house with just giving people some teas and cookies, or even just forget about the cookies, just have some teas and the speaker. The whole idea is to get gathered together and then think about the message of Karbala and what Imam Hussein alayhi salam wanted us to go through, wanted us to understand. For being a part of Imam Hussein's gathering, you do not have to go for too much of difficulties or troubles. It's just as easy as just sharing a tissue, a cup of water. Even the intention of, you know, because these days not all people can afford organizing a party or anything like that. So just having the intention that if I had enough of money, if I had enough of a place, I would have done such a gathering is enough for you to be considered as the people who are sharing as much as they can to cooperate with these sort of gatherings and the holy month of Muharram.
Right. Sister, you know, I was like, you never know, these sincere intentions make miracles.
Exactly.
Right. I think the economical issues are not just in one particular country. They are everywhere.
Exactly. So we cannot stop the rituals. And, you know, it's not in our hand. God is doing the whole story. So
exactly.
Even if you think you do not have
with someone to host.
Exactly.
It's not necessarily like I was not able to host independently as an individual to host the entire ceremony. You can participate. Mm-hmm. You can give as much as you want. There's never a force on you.
Yeah.
You can just keep it as simple as that.
Exactly. So before we get into this aspect of these gatherings, I was talking about Muslim ladies and how they are going to attend these gatherings. Just imagine it is the gathering for the funeral of a dear lost one.
Things that comes in the preparation when attending the majlis, it's customary to dress modestly, you know, to not put on makeup.
To look like a person who's mourning.
Who has lost someone yeah. very close to heart. Non-Muslims I have seen attending just because they want their desires to come true, you know, they want their wishes to come true. So, you know, Husaini Majlis is kind of
for the blessings,
open to all,
because
yeah.
these gatherings are a source of blessings. They're not going to get out of those gatherings empty-handed. This was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell and do not forget us from your praying. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden Files.
Well, there's a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly are indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist and professor, Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison. Some have been released, and others are still incarcerated after being in prison for more than 4 decades. Well, many of these individuals were involved in revolutionary movements in the 1960s. At the time, most of the activists were teenagers. are in their 20s. Imagine that. Now, they say that they were fighting against settler colonialism and oppression. Now, these individuals are elderly in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have endured many decades in prison and have spent much of their time even in solitary confinement. Many of them are ill, and lawyers have petitioned for them to be released on the basis of compassion. However, the U.S. is still adamant about keeping them behind bars. Why?
Why American authorities felt that the Black Panthers were such a threat, and the reason why the U.S. destroyed this group and many other Black nationalist groups. What exactly were they demanding? They wanted freedom and the power to determine the destiny of Black and oppressed communities. The group believed that self-determination was key to ending their oppression, and they wanted to control the institutions in their communities. The Black Panthers were also seeking full employment for African Americans and other people of color. Due to the fact that Black communities had been exploited for hundreds of years, the group wanted an end to the theft by the capitalist system of Black people. They believed that the U.S. government was racist and prevented Black Americans from excelling. They demanded what was promised to them after slavery, and that was 40 acres of land and two mules, or the financial equivalent of it. The Black Panthers wanted decent housing for Black people and other minorities. Housing which was fit to live in. And the group was also demanding that decent education be provided to Black Americans. They wanted what they called true history to be taught, which meant exposing the true nature of American imperialism, as well as teaching the reality of how Black Americans had been exploited and how they contributed to society. The Black Panthers were looking at many aspects of life, including health, and they wanted free health care for all Black and oppressed people. And they wanted preventive medicine to be practiced in oppressed communities. One of the first demands of the Black Panthers was an end to police brutality and the murder of Black people and other oppressed people inside the United States. The Black Panthers were very aware of the connection between their own oppression and the oppression of others. Thus, they wanted an end to all wars of aggression by the United States. They said the goal of these wars was to expand domination and the oppression of people around the world. The organizations wanted the freedom for all Black and oppressed people being held in all U.S. prisons. The Panthers felt that to begin with, their incarceration was due to the racist and oppressive system. And they also believed that any trials held for alleged crimes should be done so in front of a jury of peers. To sum it up, what the Black Panthers wanted for their people and others were land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Had these demands been met, it would have ensured the liberation, independence, and advancement of the Black community in the United States. However, the imperialist capitalist system is not designed to liberate the oppressed, but to gain the ultimate benefit from their oppression.
Well, I would like to welcome a former U.S. political prisoner to Hidden Files, who was incarcerated for 49 years.
Jalil Montarem, former member of the Black Panthers Party, which he joined at 16, and founding member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. He was incarcerated at age 19, and he was freed at age 69. He spent almost 15 years in prison. He was released in October of 2020. Jalil Montarem established the first revolutionary newspaper from prison and continues to be active. He started from inside prison, a national campaign to recognize political prisoners. He also started a UN petition against the U.S. having political prisoners.
Well, thank you for joining us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Montarem. How do you define a political prisoner?
How do we grade these categories and define who they are as a result of their resistance of being dissenters to a system of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism? For us, our comrades are freedom fighters, right? They identify them as being terrorists. Why they're terrorists? Because they're opposing the ideals and the practices of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism. Right? They are trying to alleviate our oppression, right, by any means necessary, as El Hajj Malik Shabazz has instructed us, by any means necessary. And so therefore they criminalize us, right, and bring us to criminal court in order to charge us what they call criminal offenses, right, on their books, right, in order to protect their interests, protect the state, right? And so this is the reason why they don't want to identify us as political prisoners, because they criminalize our movement. They criminalize our people. They criminalize our movement, right? We've been engaging in war against black people since 1619, all right, if you really want to understand it, all right? When they had the black codes, they had Jim Crow, right? And they have mass incarceration, right? The school-to-prison pipeline, right? It's all criminalizing our lives, right? Our efforts to be actually totally free and emancipated, right, people. And so that is the reason why they criminalize us, don't want to give us recognition, right, and understanding that there is divisions in this country, right, as a result of white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, past and race divisions in this country, and that there are people grappling with this idea that at some point in time, we have to free ourselves from a system that has been oppressing us for the last 400 years.
Well, from your experience, do you think that political prisoners are treated differently than the average prisoner?
We find that political prisoners are naturally distinguished from the regular general prison population. And the reason why is because they're educated. They're educated and they understand the nature of their relationship to the state. And therefore, they try to remove those individuals from the population because they do not want the general population to be educated and understand what is their relationship to the state in regards to being an antagonistic relationship they have with the state, particularly based upon race and class. And so for me, naturally, being an organizer in prison, I haven't been organized outside prison, been organized inside prison, I often was targeted by prison officials to be put in solitary confinement and or have other types of harassments and being deprived of certain privileges that most prisoners get. They would deprive me of that. But the only thing that did make me stronger, made me fight harder, that's all.
Well, do you think that it has been proven to the international community that political prisoners exist in the U.S., though Washington denies it?
Excellent question. You are absolutely correct. The United States does not recognize the fact that they do have political prisoners. When I first put in my, I'll give you an example. When I first submitted my petition campaign to the United Nations, this was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I had the opportunity to have a question asked of then UN ambassador to the United Nations by a guy named by the name of Andrew Young, the first black UN ambassador to the United Nations under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And the question I had asked him by a journalist who was, when he was in Paris having a press conference, was, does political prisoners exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered in the affirmative, positively, said perhaps thousands. You can Google New York Times, Andrew Young, political prisoners, and all those articles will come up. He was vilified in the press, vilified by the elite for having made that truthful statement that perhaps 1,000 political prisoners in the United States. And he was called to the carpet in the White House and told him to shut that down. Why do they do that? They do that because they don't want the world to know that there is dissent in the United States, right? They project themselves as being the moral humanitarian leader of the world, and that is a false. That's a falsehood, right? They are the greatest harbinger of and progeny of violence in the world. Not my words; those are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King prior to his being assassinated. He said the United States is the greatest progenitor of violence in the world, and we understand that. We know that.
Well, do you see a connection between the oppression of black Americans and the oppression of people worldwide?
One of the things I told the community, international community, that their freedom depends mostly on our freedom, right? Black people's freedom in the United States, right? I informed them specifically that when we are free, you will be free, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? because we are in the bastion of white supremacy. You see? And so for us, if this empire, what we call the United States, which is in fact is an empire, right? Well, an octopus, right? You can see the tentacles all over the world, right? Where they're sucking the blood and sucking the resources and sucking the labor from various, particularly mostly people of color countries around the world, all right? Now, those who engage